Greet you in Jesus' name. Thank you for that report, Brother Tim. I also enjoyed my time there, and I thought of the many moments of inspiration that were shared, that were strengthening for me. Welcome, visitors. Welcome to Laramie Augier. That is special to all of us. Sometimes in the middle of life, you all of a sudden hear about a surprising personal failure that befalls some respectable acquaintance of yours, and you think, how could they do that? What was he thinking? How could he throw away so much for so little? I imagine many fathers in Israel shook their heads in disbelief when they heard that King Saul, their first king, handsome, tall King Saul, who was a successful warrior king, was trying to murder his son-in-law. Like, what's wrong with Saul? In a fit of envy, chasing him up and down the hills of Israel to kill him. Threw away his kingdom over an anger problem, basically. What's wrong with Saul? No doubt a lot of priests wept in disbelief when they heard that King David, the man after God's own heart, most successful and admired king of Israel, the psalmist, had committed adultery and then murdered somebody trying to cover it up. What's wrong with David? Or maybe you ever wonder how the disciples looked at each other, Matthew and Bartholomew and Thomas and Philip, when they looked at each other and it dawned on them and they realized that Judas turned him in. Judas did it. One of our own, one of our inner circle here. Judas sold Jesus for $200. What was Judas thinking? Well, last time we looked at what the scripture says to children, and this morning I'd like to share the message that I had prepared for July 27, before God intervened and felt like I still want to do it. So I'll start by asking, we're not talking about children and teenagers here, but who here this morning, raise your hand if you're between 30 and 60. It's almost looks like a majority. So am I. If you hear things in this message that you think, well, that sure applies to him, you're not wrong. In a land of relatively unbothered Christian life, material plenty, we middle-aged children of God are vulnerable to what Christian writers in the past, they use the term acedia, and that's a kind of a unique word, acedia. It's not what we use today, but it was an older term. It just meant the tendency to fall into spiritual apathy or depression or restlessness, or just to senselessly yield to temptation in the middle years of your life. Surprising failures. How can we check ourselves for this malady? What is the God's answer for the problem? I want you to turn to Psalm 91. The title of this message is Fighting the Noonday Devil. Fighting the Noonday Devil. Psalm 91, we looked at this when we looked at the children's message. And there's another verse I want to lift out this time. Psalm 91, He that dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with His feathers. Under His wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. Now, the origin of the term here, the destruction that wasteth at noonday, both the Vulgate and the Septuagint Bibles take that destruction word and personify it as the midday demon, the demon that walks at midday. And so spiritual writers, you might have heard that term, the midday demon, more commonly known as the noonday devil. And it's simply referring to a unique kind of temptation that assails you in middle life, in middle age. It's a unique kind of attack of the devil. Well, let's take this apart a little bit. Is it true? Is it true that middle-aged people face unique temptations? Let's think a little bit, first of all, what happens at noon? And noon is being a metaphor for being in the middle of your life. You're not young anymore. You're not a young parent anymore. You're not an old person yet, but you're just in the middle of it. So I'm gonna paint a picture here that many of you can protest at points and say, wait, that's not true for me, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be true for you. I'm speaking in very general terms about what happens in the course of our lives. During your 20s and 30s, you tend to be under the discipline of raising babies, getting children started in school, working on your mortgages, maybe starting business ventures. There's a certain kind of discipline there. But around 40 to 55, somewhere in there, sometimes, many times, the financial pressures can ease up. We've made a little progress. You start leaning on older children at home to help you get things done. Maybe you're not up as much at night with infants anymore. Maybe not. At the same time, this is a period of your life in which you tend to have a little bit more buying power than you used to. You can afford things you didn't used to be able to afford when you were 25. And at the same time, you're getting to have more voice in the community, maybe in your church, than when you were 25 and 30. You may have employees that do your bidding. You may serve in leadership roles in business or community, or school, or you spend less time tending toddlers and more time tending the needs of grown-ups in distress. Maybe you start carrying the weight of your aging parents. All of which can leave you preoccupied and exhausted with the care of directing children, employees, and 1,000 details of family and work. You still may have reasonably good health, if God is blessing you with that. You have some idealism left, some energy, some creativity. You're not bubbling with it, maybe, like you were at 22, but you still have some energy left. Some go get them to take some new challenges on. But it's true that the initial excitement and the challenge of marriage and starting to raise a family and doing a business venture or something like that, it levels off and becomes fairly routine, and your life can feel less like an adventure and maybe more like a treadmill some days. And the combination of all this I'm describing makes us vulnerable to some unhealthy patterns that are well known. The noonday devil is just another word sometimes for what we call midlife crisis, where you suddenly come and you make a turn in the road that you didn't see coming, but you do because of a combination of developments in your life. I'd like to examine these symptoms a little bit, headed under four areas that are, I think, well known and most of us we'll probably recognize ourselves in one of these fours. Number one, care and duty overwhelms our souls. I want you to turn to Matthew 13. Where's scripture here? Matthew 13 is the story of seed falling, different kinds of soil, and he simply says, there was the seed that fell on among the thorns. And the explanation is in verse 22. He that received seed among the thorns is he that heareth the word, and the care of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word, and he becometh unfruitful. I just want to focus on the care, not the riches part here, but the care of this world chokes out the ability for that seed to become fruitful. And I don't even need to tell you, if you're between 30 and 60, how this works, do I? The care of this world, the care of your families and your work can choke out time for other things. I thought about it this way. You know, a lot of times we feel, I say we, I'm just talking for middle-aged people here, we feel that we don't fill our lives. Do you fill your day with a lot of activity and a lot of schedule things, and because you love it that way? You like it that way? I mean, the young people might say, well, why do you do that to yourself? You know, well, we don't do it because we love it this way, do we? I don't. More likely, if I'd speak for you, I'd expect that you probably struggle with some resentment. Why is it this way? Well, I can't do anything. I can't get rid of this problem or that problem. It's my, I can't do anything about it. And we resent that it's so full and there's no time for things you'd like to do. And sometimes you'll see a middle-aged person just suddenly flip a breaker and just go, I'm done. I'm closed for business. And they resign off all their responsibilities committees. Maybe they'll sell a business, sell their side projects, and just completely check out that I will not take any of this anymore. It's a midlife crisis is what it is, because they're just choked out. They can't get their breath. But more of us probably, more of the time, we keep on the treadmill. We keep on going. We do the best we can, and we hassle along, and oh my, and then we're reminded of it, and it doesn't feel good either. And so you mothers and your hassled school mornings, maybe you don't have hassled school mornings, but I'm just going to say there probably are some. But when you're trying to get everything done and you get these unrealistic meme posts on WhatsApp statuses with close-up pictures of latte art and roses and other fake things, and it's all, just take time for what's beautiful and meaningful today, and you're supposed to be inspired by that, and it feels like the last straw, because I can't do that. I've got all these babies, I've got laundry, I run a school, I've got hair to do, I've got all this stuff to do, and then, you know. And deep down in, you suspect maybe that middle-aged moms who have time to post that kind of thing all the time aren't doing their laundry or smelling roses. And so you do breakfast, and you dress the children, and you go to school, and you shop, and you garden, and you sew, and you make meals, and you clean up after six children and your husband. And it's not a picnic. I don't have to tell you that. It's not a picnic. And how are you supposed to do all that and still have time to be a sweet mother and read to your children and take quality time for him and all of that? The cares choke you. They really do. They feel like they press on you until you can't get your breath. Don't they? They can. Turn to Luke 12. Verse 16. Luke 12:16. The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits." And he said, "This will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said unto him, "Thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided?" Preoccupation, I'm talking about middle-aged businessmen now, preoccupation with work and material security is also a kind of choking down. And middle age is really, for many men, the time when they finally sort of get the economic ball rolling in America here, at least if you were blessed that way. If you're ever going to, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen when you're 22 and so on, but if things work out for you, it sort of gets rolling by middle age, and you can really get on the treadmill of that. And the rich fool's sin here was not that his crops did well, or that he wanted to make sure he took good care of them and put them in a big enough warehouse. That wasn't his sin. What was the rich man's sin here? Well, it was that he had stockpiled it for himself. "Now I can take it easy. I'm fixed up for the long haul. I'll retire and take my RV to Alaska. And I've got this thing well stocked. I have a good barn full to last me." And so success in middle life can turn a good man into a greedy man. And then he turns to covetousness. And then he becomes a rich fool, filling his barn until night comes and the judge says, "How about your soul? You ready? Got your soul ready? I'm here for your soul. Is it ready to go?" And then all he has is a barn full of corn. Well, like cares, we're talking to the mothers about cares, but like cares, pursuit of economic growth can choke out the spiritual awareness. Well, that's number one, the cares overwhelm our souls. The second thing that can happen in middle age is that first love cools. First love cools of various kinds. The most upfront kind, I think, can be that the first love of our Savior can cool because, well, you know, our conversion might have been some years ago and we've sort of gotten into the ho-hum of the Christian journey. And it seems that we can feel a little distant from spiritual vigor and the passion for doing God's work and worshiping Him and so on. And it's harder to, you know, after all, you're busy and so you can't pray and you can't read and you can get fatigued spiritually. The songwriter says, "Where is the blessedness I knew when first I saw the Lord? Where is the soul-refreshing view of Jesus and His Word?" Do I speak for any middle-aged people here that you could ask that question to sometimes? Where is the blessedness I knew when first I saw the Lord? And so we can become half-hearted towards spiritual labors even. And middle-aged people can become surprisingly grudging about their participation in whatever it is, maybe teaching Sunday school or evangelism efforts or community outreach. And a brother lamented to me recently that they have a rather large church and they can't get their school board staffed right now because they can't get anybody willing to serve on the school board in their big church. I think that's a kind of middle age crisis there. I remember the hymn years ago, it just stuck with me. Once, even when I was a younger man, hurrying to some job or something like that, and then I didn't have time to make it to some other event I was supposed to help with at church or something. But the songwriter says, "I would not with swift-winged zeal on the world's errands go, but labor up the heavenly hill with weary steps and slow." You know that song? We go with swift-winged zeal on business because we have to work, after all. And then, and the spiritual labors, we go with weary steps and slow. So that's a kind of spiritual apathy that is unique, and I'm just going to say it's unique to middle-aged men. We have all kinds of time to work, travel, play, build big stuff, and we just find it harder to serve, to fill in, to teach Sunday school, to substitute at school, to do spiritual ministry where we have an opportunity. I don't know why that is, but it's true. But the good news is we have a packed full building here. We should be one of the most well-staffed churches for heavenly laborers that's possible. So good news there. Well, another thing that can happen as your love cools, if you're not careful, is that what was once conscientiousness can give way to cynicism in middle age. Now, I want you to go to Psalm 10. Psalms 10 for this. Conscientiousness gives way to cynicism in middle age. Sometimes we think of teenagers as having oversensitive consciences and so on, but other things can happen here. I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but this isn't a wicked man now. This isn't just a tired Christian here. This is an openly wicked man. But verse 5, he's saying about God, God's not in his thoughts, his ways are always grievous. Thy judgments are far above out of sight, meaning my consciousness of God is out of my sight. Verse 6, he has said in his heart, I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity. Plucks out, he crouches and waits to prey on people. Verse 11, he has said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face, he will never see it. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up thine hand, forget not the humble. Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? He has said in his heart, thou wilt not require it. But thou hast seen it. He's saying God did see it. And it sounds awful, you know, but this is similar enough that what can beset us in middle life, even as Christians. Because we can, as we go through the bumps of life and we start to figure out things and you hear sometimes of a middle-aged man who was a Christian, supposedly, and you realize he's got caught up in some fraudulent enterprise of some kind. And see, it's not necessarily the young people who are the savviest at leading a double life. They're too green. Young people make mistakes, and they get caught. Older people you have to watch. They're more likely to lead a double life. You know why? Because if he's a sharp man, by the time he's middle-aged, a businessman has learned how the wheels go around. He knows where he can take advantage of people and where not. A young person doesn't know that. He knows that an average customer isn't that hard to fool. And he knows where the security cameras in life are. He knows where there's enforcement of regulations or not, and what you can get away with in taxes and so on and so on. And if he's not careful, his conscience can become dulled, and he sees how easy it is to be careless with his words and his promises and his money and so on. And so this is how middle-aged men fall into investment fraud and price gouging and captive industries and so on because, well, it's not that hard. You can get away with it. And so it works. There are men sitting in prisons this morning who've fallen into that and who were Christians and you know, just greed for gold can dull consciences until this happens. And it can be in other ways. That's money. Middle-aged people have gotten, many of you maybe you would say that you've gotten bumped around already since you're 20 years old. You've gotten kind of jostled around even in your brotherhood experiences. And you can get to middle age and have a sort of jaded view of how brotherhood works. You know, after all, you've met a lot of inconsistent people by the time you're 50 years old, haven't you? There's just a lot of failure out there. And And churches have problems. Different churches we were at in the past had problems. And, you know, brotherhood covenants and guidelines are, after all, pretty inconsistent. And you know how the church leaders are. They are not the sharpest cookies either. And they're not that hard to fool. And you know, you can just sort of get casual about it toward middle life that you know, hey, nobody's consistent and, you know, everybody fails a little bit to not hold the agreed upon standards. And anyway, our guidelines are rather outdated and I'm mostly keeping them. And so I'll just say at council meeting that I really appreciate the church, really appreciate the church standards. And inside, we know how to make room for ourselves. The last thing inside this note about first love cooling is that middle age is the time when victimhood gets entrenched the most deeply. By victimhood, I simply mean that those who have not laid down hurts from the past, if they haven't been able to resolve those, by the time you get into middle age, those things can become so entrenched. I've been mistreated. I was mistreated as a teenager. I was picked on in the last three churches. I've had financial setbacks. I've been left out by popular people. And as you nurse those hurts in middle age, you come to where you can no longer say, I'm sorry, or I need help, or you just lose the joy of the Lord because you've gotten so mired in self-pity. That happens in middle age, and it's really a kind of first love cooling off is what it is. The third thing, we said we have cares. The second thing was we lose our first loves. The third thing about middle age is that discouragement and restlessness replaces God's love and peace in your life. Discouragement and restlessness. Now, you can say, well, those aren't the same thing, are they? Well, yes, they are. Discouragement and restlessness can be the same thing. I'm not going to flesh this part out. I think, in a sense, many of us know that in middle age, we're vulnerable to discouragement. We're overwhelmed with the needs in our families. We're overwhelmed with the needs in our work, maybe. Hiring people, employee problems, helping your parents. Maybe there's stress in your extended family somewhere. And you start to struggle. Maybe it descends all the way to depression, but at least you struggle with discouragement because life just doesn't seem to get any better. Some of the common symptoms of a discouraged middle-aged person or a depressed one is that it's just easy to procrastinate your parenting, your work assignments, because you don't have the heart to do it. You don't have the energy to do it. You have an inability to control yourself in unhealthy eating or drinking, whatever that is for you. Maybe trouble sleeping or getting up. Low energy for work. And you say, well, that's all of us. Are we all depressed? When you're middle-aged, you lose some of the energy. No, but it's true that when you're really discouraged, if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. It gets worse. You might just be bored and restless. Let's go to 2 Samuel 13 here, just for a little comparison. Maybe this isn't the best example, but I've been struck by this already. And I'll just sort of tell the story a little bit here. But 2 Samuel 13 is when it was after David sinned and he was punished and so on. And Absalom was starting to be a mess, and so was Amnon. His boys weren't behaving well. And there was the time there where Amnon defiled his sister, and he got chased out and killed by the other brothers. And Absalom was on the run, and David wasn't doing anything about it. If you look at 2 Samuel 13:21, when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. And then he did what? He did nothing. He was just angry, and he did nothing about the problem in his family. And if you follow the chapter here, verse 37, Absalom fled. And it says David mourned for his son every day, but he fled. And chapter 14, Absalom's gone for a long time. And Joab's interceding, he's saying, you can't just let Absalom come back home now. You can't be angry all the time here. And verse 24 of chapter 14, the king said, let Absalom turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So King David was the man to fix this problem. And he just said, I don't want to see Absalom. I don't want to see him. And during those years, when Absalom was trying to get his dad's attention, he was starting to get the people's attention and say, you know, dad's got problems. And other people tried to intervene and say, you need to go talk to Absalom. And verse 28, so Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. And so on. The story goes on, but the point is that you have a middle-aged father here who is not dealing with the things he should deal with, because I don't know why. He certainly had reason to be discouraged with how things had been going for him. But the other flip side of discouragement is just restlessness, the quest for new excitement. You know, middle-aged people can become some of the even more restless than teenagers sometimes, just for a change. I just need a change. A new environment, a new activity, something. Ben Franklin said, the difference between men and boys is the price of their toys. It's true. You get restless in middle age, and now you can finally buy that boat or that new pickup or build the house you couldn't afford at 25, or take a trip to Europe or get a cabin in Wyoming or get into collecting or antiques or something. You see middle-aged people do this. Why? Well, they're restless. I mean, life has become kind of uninteresting, and you got to have a new something to excite you. This is a feature of middle age. You can buy your excitement now. You're the adventurous type. Maybe you need time to try skydiving or some new skill you haven't had before. People try rock climbing and all kinds of things because they need a new buzz in the middle of their life. It can even come down to we become restless in our brotherhoods and it's time to start a new church. That's a little fresher approach. It's time to relocate. Try a different vocation. All of those things can happen. I'm not saying those are evil things. I'm just saying it can come out of a soul that's restless in middle age, and even more darkly, it's the time in middle age when people can be tempted to find new excitement in a romantic interest outside their marriage. Restlessness can lead you down dark trails when your heart is not at peace with God anymore. So that's the fourth and last one I have here, is that in middle age, we are especially vulnerable to some sudden great temptation like infidelity. We're especially vulnerable to that in middle age. The combination of the first three, busyness, spiritual fatigue, and boredom, those three, busyness, spiritual fatigue, cooling first loves, you know, and boredom, can make the perfect opening to bring a terrible temptation into your life at middle age. And your spiritual resistance is down, and you can go to the stocks like the Proverbs fool before you know it. I want you to turn to 2 Samuel 11. We were close to that a minute ago, but I'm not going to read all this story. In just a few verses, I want to point out, this is right before David catastrophically falls into adultery. But you look at verse 19, right before chapter 11. Chapter 10 of 2 Samuel is all about David's great victories. He was victorious, so much so, verse 19, when all the kings that were servants to Hadarezer saw that they were smitten before Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians feared to help the children of Ammon anymore. And there's other verses about there that basically said this. David was at the top of his game. His triumph was complete. he was a powerful king, and things were just in line. And chapter 11, verse 1, it came to pass after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still at Jerusalem, and it came to pass in the evening, and so on. David was at the prime of his success and leadership, and at that moment, a great and overwhelming temptation just made him fall like a rock. Now, we often read this story as David is a predator, Bathsheba's a victim. I don't know what the full story was, but I question that. I know he was a powerful man, and she would have found that rather irresistible, but you know, maybe they were both exhibiting a midlife crisis. We don't read of resistance from her side, like Joseph, you know, running out of the room. She sends secretly word to David later, saying, you know, I'm with child, and we don't read that she confessed it to Uriah. We don't know the whole story. I'm just saying that there's often two sides when this happens, and the most common divorce age in America is 30 to 50, and we see it in our culture all around us. Middle-aged men and women are not stopped from infidelity by the fact that they're no longer as physically attractive as they once were. That doesn't stop them. The devil can and does deceive plenty of out-of-shape men into believing that they're still charming, and they're not. Plenty of neglected and stodgy wives can still feel flattered by some new attention, and they fall like a rock in middle age because the pressures of life have choked out our consciences and leave us hungry for something, for adventure. Furthermore, especially for men, the power of authority and money, one or the other or both, and it's terrible when it's both. The power of authority and money in middle age makes a man think he's invincible and he can bend the rules. And how many CEOs sit in prison and fall all the time for this very thing? They think they're invincible. They think they can bend the rules and not pay for it. And the cells of American prisons hold many, too many, middle-aged Christian men who threw away their whole lives because they couldn't discipline themselves to resist sexual temptations. It's deadly serious. Every man thinks he'd never be a predator, but his descent begins in small sins. And the men who stay out of prison are the ones who cry out like Joseph, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" That's the kind of sensitivity that we need to be strong in middle age. Besides, it's not the prison that we need to be afraid of. That only lasts for a few decades. It's eternal judgment. So, in conclusion, I've painted this rather bleak picture, and I'm sorry, about how it can be in middle age. So, the positive side of this is not to be depressed about the temptations that can be part of our lives. The positive side is James 4, where he says, "Resist the noonday devil, and he will flee from you." Now, he certainly is not going to flee if you don't put up any resistance. I mean, if you invite him in for tea, he's certainly not going to leave. And so our response to these things is certainly true. And you can think about how David's story could have ended so differently. What if David had been out there beside Uriah fighting the enemy, instead of dawdling away at home adulterously? I mean, think about how his story ended. King David barefoot with dirt on his head and people throwing rocks at him on the way out of Jerusalem, people cursing him, his son hanging in a tree. Later, a son like Solomon, unrestrained in his passions. It was a terrible ending. He could have been out fighting with Uriah, alongside him, helping him. It's just like modern day men, husbands, fathers, dawdling away with porn on their phones instead of leading their family and their wife and their children to fight the enemy. That's exactly what it's like in our day. Well, name the devil. What is it for you? Maybe you should ask your wife to name it for you, and your wife should ask your husband to name your devil. What is the noonday devil for you? Maybe it's anger. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's lust, greed, pride. I don't know. Paul says we aren't ignorant of his devices, so it means we need to name the devil. We need to nurture our hungers, because the noonday devil is seeking whom he may devour. And who does he devour? He devours hungry men and women. That is to say, if your soul is empty, if it's not fed, you're the first pickings for noonday devils, because you're easy. You're an easy target. If you're not taking time for worship yourself, and yes, it's that literal. If I, as a middle-aged person, do not have time to pray and read my word, read the word of God, I'm essentially advertising to Satan, saying, here, try me. I'm an easy target. That's how it is. We have to ask God. And Jesus says, come, take my yoke. It's easy. I'll help you. And we have to cry out, I'm discouraged, God. I need help today. Don't be surprised. You won't be surprised if your middle-aged friends, if you tell them how you feel, they're not going to be surprised. They'll say, I know what you're talking about. I think that one of the strongest ways, there's a quote here I wanted to read. One of the strongest ways to not fall catastrophically in middle age is to cultivate our conscientiousness in the little virtues, in the little things. Hannah Moore says here, it's an awesome consideration and one which every Christian should bring home. Whether small faults willfully persisted in may in time not only dim the light of conscience but extinguish the spirit of grace. Will indulgence in small faults ultimately dissolve all power of resistance against great evil? And the idea is there that if I am careless about the speed limit, about cutting corners with my money, about not really getting any better about my irritability with my children, or my fits of anger, my temper problem, my procrastination problems, my poor self-control with food, you name it. All the little sins in our lives, the little things that we are working on, you know, if I'm careless about those things, surely we are eroding our spiritual sensitivity to where we fall like a rock in the end. Well, Jesus says, put on the armor. Paul says, put on the armor that you may be able to withstand the wiles of the noonday devil. And the good news is that in Jude, we give this as a benediction. He is able to keep you from what? Falling. And present you how? Faultless. How many faultless 30 to 60 year olds are here? No, you know a whole list. In fact, your children know the list pretty well too, how faultless you are. He is able to keep us middle-aged people from falling and present us faultless before the presence of his glory. How? With exceeding joy. Now, I don't know about you, but that's the way I'd like to be presented. With exceeding joy before God. I would like to hear the words, well done, you good and tired middle-aged man or woman. Well done. Well done. Present you with joy before the Father. It's possible, brothers and sisters. It is possible. It's possible with God's grace. And I entreat you to
to come and tell me if you think I'm in danger. And you need to have that pact with each other. Because one of us could suddenly fall if we're not paying attention. And that would be a tragedy. Let's pray.